Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. More than 30 people were killed by ISIS attacks in Baghdad this morning, and ISIS is leaving a trail of IEDs elsewhere in Iraq.
We'll have that story in a moment, but first, another big drop today on Wall Street at the opening bell after a series of difficult days around the world for global markets. So is this just falling oil prices or a sign of deeper trouble in the global economy? Larry Summers is the former U.S. Treasury Secretary under President Bill Clinton, former top economic advisor under President Obama, and now an economist at Harvard. I sat down with him this morning at his home outside Boston. Larry Summers, welcome back to Here and Now.
Glad to be with you.
What do you think is going on in the stock market right now? Why has it dropped about 1,500 points in the last month?
There's been a negative reassessment of prospects for the global economy, the prospects of what I and others have called secular stagnation. Look more real today than they did a few months ago. The news out of Europe has been continuously discouraging. The risks that the United States will remain in a somewhat deflationary situation look greater than they did 2 months ago. The news out of China is not all the way to alarming, but it's certainly not highly encouraging. And so it's a combination of many different developments, none of which are favorable for growth. And of course, it feeds on itself. A lower and more volatile stock market creates a world with more uncertainty, which discourages investment, which in turn makes economic performance get worse.
And when you say secular stagnation, you're talking about what?
I'm talking about a situation where, for more than just a transitory period associated with a recession, the economy's capacity to produce, and especially for there to be demand for all that is produced, is not enough to fully employ the population.
You're talking about a lot of different things happening around the world, and a lot of these things are fears that people have. But do you believe that those fears are justified, that Europe is going to go back into recession, that China is entering a slowdown?
I believe those risks are rationally assessed significantly greater than they were several months ago. And that's enough of a reason for people to judge, revise downwards their prospects. I think in Europe, the risks are particularly great. There's a systematic mistake that people make, which is they confuse stopping the financial hemorrhaging with making everything okay. And so people thought when the financial hemorrhaging was staunched in the United States in 2009, that things were okay and we could go back to budget cutting. And the consequences were that we've had a much slower recovery than we could have had. People in Europe believed that when it became clear that the Eurozone was going to hang together, that everything would be okay, and that didn't happen. There's a lesson that we need to learn, which is that it takes a long time to firmly reestablish recovery, and that you need a lot of energy and demand directed at that objective. And that's the mistake that keeps being made around the world.
So is it a mistake then for the Fed to end its bond buying stimulus program this month?
It certainly is no time for the Fed to be raising interest rates. Deflation, not inflation, is the greater risk today. Not enough spending, not overspending, is the greater risk today. The Fed has carried on a policy that was set quite some time ago, and I don't have a quarrel with that judgment. After all, the objective of quantitative easing policies is in substantial part to bring down long-term interest rates, and the 10-year Treasury has moved from about 3% at the beginning of the year to about 2% today, and that's going to, over time, translate into mortgage relief, for homeowners. But I do absolutely believe that we need to keep our eye on the fact that slowdown and deflation are our greater risk, much as so many voices want to turn the debate to what at this point look very hypothetical fears around inflation.
So if you were Fed chair, you would be ending quantitative easing now as well?
You know, I don't answer questions that are put in quite that way, but I have no quarrel with the existing policy. I do have a quarrel with those who are recommending that as a matter of urgency, policy be further tightened.
What about on the fiscal side? At what point will it be time for Washington to really start thinking about the U.S.'s long-term debt? We saw just yesterday that the deficit is more than $400 billion.
I would put it in a very different way. We saw yesterday that the deficit was 2.8% of GDP, that is smaller relative to GDP than we've had at any time in the last 40, that we had on average over the last 40 years.
You're saying that's healthy.
And that's a pretty good, that's a pretty good deficit figure. Are there issues for the long run? Yes, there are. But we have had a massive excess of focus on financial debt. But I'm much more worried about the legacy we are leaving our children of inadequate infrastructure, of bridges that are on the brink of collapse, of airports that are a national embarrassment. And something remarkable happened last week. The IMF, the international organization that's traditionally the leading advocate of austerity, asserted in its flagship publication that proper infrastructure investment programs paid for themselves in the form of lower debt burdens. I would just ask this question. If a time when the interest rate is 2% and the construction unemployment rate in double digits, is not the time to fix Kennedy Airport, is not the time to clean up schools with crumbling paint, when will that time ever come?
But if that time didn't come when we were in the midst of a financial crisis and a very deep recession, and people didn't build high-speed trains all across the country and update our road infrastructure, then why would it happen now? What is going to convince people who were unconvinced then?
Hopefully what will convince them is the rather unfortunate legacies of the choices they made at that time, in terms of the fact that in this country right now, more than one in seven men between 25 and 54 are not working. That's a profound threat to our social fabric, and that's something we've got to be addressing in a much more serious way than we are today.
I want to ask you one more question, Larry Summers. It's a little off the track here, but it's something that I've been asked many times by friends, peers, about their own personal job situation, which is if somebody came to you and said, I've got a job right now, but I haven't had the kind of raises that I'd like to see in recent years. I haven't been promoted the way that I'd like to be promoted, but I don't have another job to go to yet. Should I leave this job that I'm not happy with before I have another job to go to? What would you tell them?
This is still an economy with a lot of insecurity. Firms are hunkered down. Firms that are laying people off tend not to be firms that are rushing to provide new opportunity to people from the outside. So people who have a secure, if not ideal situation, probably in their own interest, should be cautious.
Larry Summers, former Treasury Secretary, former top economic advisor to President Obama, now an economist at Harvard. Thank you so much, as always, for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Well, now to Iraq, where more than 30 people were killed by ISIS attacks targeting Shiites in Baghdad today. ISIS militants, largely Sunni, are still trying to take the capital after huge gains in the west and north. In the north, Kurdish Peshmerga troops have pushed back ISIS, but the Islamic fighters are leaving behind deadly IEDs, or improvised explosive devices. The BBC's Jim Muir reports on a British company that's helping the Kurds defuse that threat.
In a field on the eastern side of Iraqi Kurdistan, a man dressed in what looks like an astronaut's suit lies in the dried grass, poking gingerly at the dusty ground with skewers and scanning it with an electronic device. Then he starts waving a long wand around, producing even stranger noises. It isn't, of course, for real. The man on the ground is one of 20 Peshmerga trainees being taught how to deal with deadly bomb devices, as one of the trainers explained.
What he's doing is he's approaching a target. He's been told there's something hidden. Then there may be a victim-operated device protecting it so that it kills the police if they come and take it. He's looking essentially for trip wires of different types and especially the pressure mats, which is pretty much a favourite switch used by IS.
So he's dressed up like a kind of deep sea diver. If a bomb were to go off, would he be seriously injured? Or
it would depend, obviously, how big the bomb is. But I mean, a big bomb, he probably would be very seriously injured, if not killed. But when you see him lying sprawled on the ground, that's when he's actually found something. What he's doing is he's minimising his profile to any explosions. Hopefully, a lot of it will go up and above his head.
I was down on one of the fronts recently, and they had lost a Peshmerga, who was a bomb disposal guy. They'd lost him to a bomb. This is a very real exercise. It's not just playing.
No, not at all. We're getting information from these guys. They're telling us what sort of things they're finding. One of the main attacks that IS certainly are using are the roadside bombs that you used to see in Iraq and Afghanistan, where there's either some sort of command-initiated device, a wire or a radio, mobile phone, etc. Mm-hmm. It's such an effective weapon that any insurgent force can use an IED, and the problem is they're notoriously difficult to detect.
I'm Simon de Grishy, and I'm the Managing Director of Explosive Risk Management, or a company designed to provide training and capability and equipment to counter the threat from IEDs.
Now, you were saying that the threat here is quite sophisticated. It's not just wild guys putting any old bombs there, right?
IEDs are being seeded along routes and in urban areas, which prevent A, freedom of movement of the follow-up troops, but also to prevent the reoccupation of those areas by the civilian population. They have a wide range of capability to mount sophisticated attacks using IEDs, and their IED technology is very, very sophisticated.
At the end of 4 weeks' training, can these guys go out there and pretty much detect things and deal with them?
At the end of 4 weeks' training, not only can these guys do it, they will be doing it. Every single one of these students is going to be a frontline IED operator. Yes, these guys will be able to effectively deal with deployed IEDs.
The newly trained experts can't get there too soon. One thing that's certain is that their efforts will save lives against this deadly threat. And it's more than likely that in doing so, some of them will sacrifice their own.
The BBC's Jim Muir reporting from Iraqi Kurdistan.
It's here and now, and with just 19 days until Election Day, there are a lot of crazy politics going on right now, but you'd have to put this item at the top of that list. Last night, there was a gubernatorial debate in Florida between Governor Rick Scott, the Republican, and former Governor Charlie Crist, who is now a Democrat. Crist had a fan placed underneath his podium, which Scott's campaign says was against the rules, barring electronic devices. So at the beginning of the debate, Crist showed up. Scott did not. Debate hosts were flummoxed, and Rosemary Goudreau of the South Florida Sun-Sentinel asked Crist what the rules were.
Do the rules of the debate say that there should be no fan?
Not that I'm aware of.
So the rules that the Scott campaign just showed us that says that no electronics can be used,
including
fans?
Are we really going to debate about a fan? Or are we going to talk about education and the environment and the future of our state? I mean, really. We were placed in the awkward situation of having to decide this, and I don't think it's our role to determine.
Well, Governor Scott finally did walk out on stage, prompting this remark from CBS 4 debate host Elliot Rodriguez.
Ladies and gentlemen, that has to be the most unique beginning to any debate.
I don't think we'll forget.
Not only in Florida, but I think anywhere in the country. Let us start.
Now, Charlie Crist fan is something of a fixture in Florida politics, and for 4 years now, it's had its own Twitter account. Today, the fan tweeted of the famously tanned Crist, "Tan Man and I live by our own rules."
And we're about to check in again with our digital and social media producer, Rachel Rohr, who's been on the road for the past month ahead of the midterm elections, speaking to young Americans across the country, finding out where they stand on politics, but all sorts of other fascinating things as well. Rachel, last time we talked, you were in the capital of the Navajo Nation, Window Rock, Arizona. Where are you now?
Today, I'm in Milford, Pennsylvania. We're actually expecting to be back in Boston sometime tomorrow.
Well, we'll be glad to see you, but sorry to see this wrap up. It's been so much fun. Where have you been since we last checked with you?
Well, after the Navajo Nation, we drove north to Utah, where we spent time in two different cities, Provo, home to Brigham Young University, which is owned and operated by the Mormon Church, and Salt Lake City, Utah's capital. BYU has a strict honor code that includes not drinking coffee, tea, or alcohol, so it was interesting to be in a college town with almost no bars or coffee shops. The honor code also bans male students from having beards, and I met a 23-year-old BYU student from California named Shane Pitson, who's leading an effort to overturn that rule. He recently organized a demonstration called Bike for Beards.
A lot of the student body feels pretty similar. Might be a little bit of an outdated rule, but there are a couple. There was one kid that ripped up my flyers in my face and then threw them in the trash and was like, if you don't like the rules here, then you can leave. There's other people that would want to go here and obey the rules. And I was like, I obey the rules. I just think this should change.
Beards are not against the Mormon faith, so why can't they have them at BYU?
Well, the rule dates back to the late 60s when facial hair was a sign of the counterculture movement and rebellion. Shane's making the argument that beards don't have the same connotation now, and there's a practical reason to get rid of the rule, too. Shane told me it's particularly hard on students who get a prominent 5 o'clock shadow. He had a roommate who had to shave twice in one day in order to not be turned away from the testing center.
Well, that is harsh. But, this is the point. This is important to him. But other things are on the minds of young Mormons. What did you hear?
I met a 31-year-old BYU law student named Morgan Brungard, who told me one of the biggest issues within the Mormon church right now is same-sex relationships and marriage. The church stance is that it does not condemn people who are attracted to people of the same sex, but it does prohibit acting on that attraction. So it's against same-sex relationships and marriages. Morgan explained that from her perspective, it's hard to tell someone not to have a family when that's the main focus of the religion.
In a church where we believe the mother-father responsibility as well as spouse is one of the most important and sacred that there is, and also where true happiness comes from, how to say to somebody, yes, but you can't have that.
Morgan does want same-sex marriage to be legal so couples can have the same legal benefits, but within the church, she's not sure if same-sex relationships should be allowed. She did say, though, that she supports her gay friends in whatever they decide, even if they decide to leave the church to have a family.
That's Here and Now's Rachel Rohrer. She's been traveling the country talking to millennials. We just heard a young Mormon in Utah talking about same-sex marriage. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, and Rachel, we know the Mormon Church heavily funded the fight to ban same-sex marriage in California. But you were in Salt Lake right when same-sex marriage became legal in Utah. As we know, the Supreme Court last week decided not to hear 5-state same-sex marriage challenges, and that cleared the way for same-sex marriage in those states. Utah was one of them. Church officials said when this all happened, as far as the civil law is concerned, the courts have spoken, but a top leader told a Mormon conference that legalizing same-sex marriage is among the world values threatening Mormon beliefs. So a lot was going on right when you were there.
Yes, it was actually right after I talked with Morgan that I heard the news. And coincidentally, I already had an interview lined up in Salt Lake City with a 31-year-old transgender activist named Owen Smith. He's hoping there will be more focus on transgender issues in Utah now that same-sex marriage is legal.
It's really warm and fuzzy to talk about love and relationships, and people get to watch romantic comedies and all those things. So it's more fun to talk about than the trans woman of color who was murdered, right? It's not as fun. It's not as heartwarming. It hurts to talk about those things. It hurts to see that side of humanity. So I think that a lot of emphasis is put on marriage because it's just easier to talk about.
Owen told me that there have been 25 acts of violence against transgender people in Salt Lake City so far this year. And transgender people of color are most at risk. Owen put me in touch with 20-year-old Gabriel Glissmeyer. He's a black transgender college student and activist who was adopted and raised by a white Mormon family in Utah. I asked Gabe what the biggest issue is that he's working to combat.
The biggest thing that I'm combating every day is just staying alive at this point. It's terrible having to leave my house and just being like, oh, like, I don't, like, this could be, like, the last time I'm, like, I see my family, and this is, like, the last time I could see my friends. And so just leaving my house is, like, terrifying for me at this point, but I still do it because I'm like, oh, there's so much, like, work I need to do, and there's so many lives I need to change and people who need to hear me.
Gabe told me that he fears for his life every day, not because he's perceived as transgender, but because he's perceived as a black male. He wants what he calls real-world issues like police brutality, gun violence, and domestic violence to be part of the LGBT conversation.
Well, so we started with the campaign to get the right to wear a beard, and, you know, we've gone quite deep into other issues that you found in Utah. Now, part of your project has focused on whether young people want to stay or go from the place they grew up in. What did Gabe tell you?
Well, he does not want to stay in Utah. He's actually in the process of transferring from the University of Utah to the University of Minnesota. He had an internship in Minneapolis over the summer and really connected with a group of young transgender people of color there. So part of it is he loves Minneapolis, and the other part is he's never felt at home in Utah. In fact, he introduced himself to me as being from Cleveland, even though he was adopted and brought to Utah at 3 months old.
Here and now is Rachel Rohr, driving cross-country, talking to young Americans, and on her way home. So look for all her pictures and interviews at our Tumblr. We'll link you up at hereandnow.org. Rachel, thank you.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Today, CBS announced a new standalone online streaming service that does not require a cable or satellite subscription or even an antenna. CBS All Access would allow people in certain cities to watch the network's live programming, with the exception of NFL games and thousands of older shows, in the CBS archive. It is the first move of its kind from a traditional broadcaster, and it comes just a day after HBO said it would start an internet-only service. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, this just makes me break up, clearly. But tell us, what do you think about this CBS move?
Well, it's a continuous feed of CBS that, like you said, is going to be available in 14 cities. That means both streaming live television more or less continuously and having old shows, Big Bang Theory, Two and a Half Men, NCIS, some of the most popular stuff on TV, but also old stuff like Cheers and MacGyver without any football. What I think about it is that even if this product itself doesn't prove to be terrifically popular, I think that we're at a tipping point right now. We're at the point where it is possible to say we have reached peak cable. The cable business in television, which has been one of the great industries of the last 30 years, one of the most profitable industries still today, had its total number of subscribers to cable and satellite, like you said, fall for the first time last year. And I think that you're beginning to see the media companies look at this and say, this is a huge business, a fantastic business, but it could be a very slowly dying business. And we need to get creative about putting our content in front of people where the people are.
We're going to a la carte TV, you think?
Well, I think that for a long time we're going to have both. If you look, we still have 100 million households approximately that have a cable subscription of some sort. That is too big an industry to give up on, and it's going to change very slowly because for all sorts of reasons, I don't think older households are going to give up a cable bundle that they absolutely adore, spend 4 or 5 hours a day in front of, to give that up to cobble together something with Netflix and Hulu and this new CBS product. So I think that what's going to happen is you're going to see an accelerated aging of the cable bundle. I think younger people that have avoided cable by tuning into this internet TV are going to have more options and more reasons to not buy cable. And the older folks and the older households that already have cable are probably going to keep it, and they are going to be responsible for the rest of this business as long as it's around.
But if we're moving in that direction, you would think that Netflix would be the place to be because they've already got the infrastructure for this kind of thing. And yet you see this morning at the open on Wall Street, their stock drops more than 20%.
Right. You know, I was thinking about this earlier. In a way, I was joking with a friend. Netflix is a little bit like Magellan. It's the explorer who was the first to cross the ocean but actually died in the process. You know, Netflix proved that this works, that people want to watch streaming television on their phones and on their televisions and on their iPads and things like this. But they proved that it works so well that everyone is now thinking, oh, wait, we own the content. We own all the entertainment that we're selling to Netflix. Why are we selling it to them for cheap? We should be controlling our own pipes and selling it to people and making them pay us for the stuff that we do. So in a way, Netflix was this fantastic fantastically important technological explorer to prove that this business model could work. But now I think you're going to see, you know, HBOs and CBSs of the world try to make it work for themselves. That doesn't mean that Netflix is doomed. It still has terrific growth, particularly internationally. But I do think that you're going to start to see these entertainment companies try to get a hold of their entertainment.
And it has House of Cards and Orange is the New Black and other great shows. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now, and we want to check in Ohio, where there's news that a parent in Akron, whose child attended one of three schools in the state that were closed, actually had contact with Ebola patient Amber Vinson, who you'll remember traveled to Cleveland and then flew back to Dallas with a temperature of 99.5 before being diagnosed with Ebola. Prior to the news of the parents, schools had been closed and disinfected when it was discovered that a teacher flew the same route as Vinson, though a day later than Vinson did. Nick Castell is with the Here and Now contributing station WCPN in Cleveland. And Nick, we talked to you earlier, and you know, a lot of people were wondering, gee, is that really a, you know, why do you have to close schools when a teacher flew just the same route, but not even the same day or the same plane as Amber Vinson? Now you have this parent who reportedly had contact with Amber Vinson. What kind of contact?
Well, it's not clear exactly what kind of contact. A letter from the superintendent of Akron Public Schools simply says the parent did have contact with Amber Vinson and the parent was being quarantined now. They've decided to dismiss class for the rest of the day. The school will also be closed tomorrow, and it's planning. The plan is to reopen it on Monday, and in the process it will be thoroughly disinfected.
Well, but I have the letter here that was sent to parents from the Akron Public Schools, you know, telling them that it's an extreme precautionary measure. But do we know if the child, you know, had any contact?
We know that the child did not have any contact with Amber Vinson. That's laid out pretty clearly in the letter. So we're really only talking about this parent who had contact.
Yeah.
And I think there's a bigger picture here that Summit County health officials, that's the county where Akron is located, they've said, you know, having contact with an Ebola patient, someone who actually is expressing symptoms, that's a risk for Ebola. Having contact with someone who had contact with a patient but who is not expressing symptoms, that is not a risk for Ebola. So we're talking about a small number of people here who did have contact with Amber Vinson. That number, Summit County health officials say, is seven. Seven people they've identified had contact with her, and they are quarantined now.
Right. Well, and we remember, too, that Amber Vinson, at least according to the reports that we have, might have had this very slight temperature, but she also had no symptoms. What, you know, the sweating or the throwing up, the fluids that are the real danger. Anyway, before that, the schools that were closed just because a teacher had been on the same route, you know, of a flight. Were people, you know, are people thinking that maybe this is just a little bit extreme?
I think the phrase of the day is out of an abundance of caution.
Mm-hmm.
Schools are going above and beyond what they're asked to do because they just want to leave the public absolutely certain that they're doing what they can to make sure no one has any reason to worry.
It's a balance, you know, keeping people safe but not shutting down, you know, schools and all activity in an area, which will, of course, shut the area down. Nick Castell of WCPN in Cleveland, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Cleveland is not alone in reacting to the fear of contracting Ebola. A Gallup poll shows one in four Americans fear they're at risk of contracting the disease. And a Harvard School of Public Health study says as many as 40% are worried they'll catch Ebola. Are people overreacting? Jody Lenard is a psychiatrist and risk communication consultant. She's with us now. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, are Americans' fears about Ebola rational, given that only one person has died in the U.S. from this disease?
I think the fears are almost entirely rational. It's a new situation. It's very scary. People are paying justified attention. I think when people are afraid that they're actually going to catch Ebola, that's excessive, but they will get past that as they learn the information. They're learning mainly who can they trust to tell them things, and do those people know what they're doing?
So you're saying that people don't have a high chance of actually catching it and they will figure that out eventually, but for right now, the fears make sense?
I think all the different levels of the fears make sense, and people will get past their initial adjustment reaction much better if officials are respectful of their fears rather than always saying that they're irrational, hysterical, or about to panic.
So you're saying the message from officials is not what it should be?
Well, some are and some aren't, but there's an awful lot of people speaking to the media about how the public is overreacting. And you can cite individual examples where an uninformed public that hasn't learned yet, you know, that Zambia isn't the same as Liberia, might be afraid to let their school principal come back from his trip to Zambia. But give them a few days and they'll figure it out just fine. It's not irrational to wonder. It would be irrational if they continued to believe that somebody from Zambia was a risk when he hadn't been anywhere near the affected countries.
But aren't some people overreacting given the fact that one person's died from Ebola, more than 37,000 people die in car crashes every year?
Yeah. Let me tell you what I think about all the people who are saying you shouldn't be so worried about Ebola. You should be worried about the flu, obesity, car crashes,
right,
not exercising enough, drinking, drugs. I could go on. The reason that that's a really bad risk comparison is that we have already decided how worried to be about the flu and all those other things. You know, every year we think about – most of us think about whether to get a flu shot or not. We pay attention if we hear that the flu is around in our neighborhood. We're always worrying about car crashes, but not that much, mostly when we hear about one that's nearby or somebody we know is in one. We're not going to decide this week that this is the week we should pay more attention to driving safety. This is the week we are going to learn about Ebola.
What does it do to our level of fear about this, that what many Americans know about diseases like Ebola comes from Hollywood movies like Contagion and Outbreak?
Those movies are remarkably good primers for people to know a little bit more about this. Those movies obviously have the most gross aspects of a disease like Ebola, and it's all well and good for me to say, oh, only 40% or so of people actually have hemorrhaging, but that's an awful lot of bleeding. So if you actually put scenes from Liberia or Sierra Leone up on the screen next to scenes from Contagion, the only thing really different for the scenes from Liberia and Sierra Leone is that there's no sound. And if you were actually there, the smells would be a lot worse. I mean, you know, everybody I know in my field really thinks a lot about zombie movies because it is so close to some of our worst fears about what things like Ebola are like where you could just get it by a touch from somebody's body fluids, or you scratch your neck after treating a patient and your glove has a hole in it. I mean, it's really, really a horror of a disease.
So you're saying be afraid, be very afraid?
No, I'm saying pay attention, learn what there is to learn. If you're still afraid of catching Ebola in a month when there's nobody around you that has any connection with West Africa or a sick patient or a nurse, then you'll be getting into the sort of post-traumatic stress era. But I've talked to lots and lots of emergency room doctors in the last 2 weeks. They are not being flooded with the worried well. They are getting a few isolated incidents of people who think that they were maybe exposed to the third cousin of somebody who, you know, two generations ago came back from Liberia. But that is the exception, not the rule. People are not panicking.
Jody Lenard, psychiatrist and risk communication consultant, thanks for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Fall is here, and so we're bidding a sad farewell to tomatoes and corn, but saying a hearty hello to Swiss chard and bok choy. At least we will when we know what to do with them. And here to help us with that is Here Now resident chef Kathy Gunst. Kathy, good to see you as always.
Hi, Robin.
So expound. Fall greens, what are they?
Well, they're all those hearty greens. You know, this is that time of year. It's almost like where you switch your coat. You go from that light summer sweater to like the first fall coat. These fall greens are hearty. They get better as the weather gets colder. They love a frost. It turns them sweeter. We're talking about Swiss chard. We're talking about collard greens. We're talking about kale. We're talking about pak choy and bok choy, arugula, Brussels sprouts, even turnip greens. These are all the hearty greens that will last through a frost, even two or three.
And what about parts of the country where they don't have a frost? Do they not do as well in heat, so maybe they're planting now?
A lot of these don't like heat. So in the south, for instance, where it's going to be cooler this winter, but not freezing, they will just be planting their fall greens right now,
okay,
and they're fabulous.
Well, you mentioned one there along the way, kale, and people might have heard the inflection in your voice. You, in December, said that you thought that kale might be on the way out. In fact, I think you said you hoped that kale might be on the way out.
You know what? There's a first for everything, and I was wrong.
It's hotter than ever.
It's crazy. It's become completely mainstream. Driving into the station today, I passed two billboards for huge companies publicizing kale drinks. It's just out of control. However, when you eat it minimally, and when you eat it in creative ways, it's absolutely terrific. A woman I know named Kathy Walters has just written a book called Kale, Glorious Kale, and she has some really creative takes. She has kale cocktails, but she also has some fabulous salads, and you have one in front of you.
Which one is this?
That is the one right in front of you with the apples and the nuts and the feta. It's almost like a kale Waldorf. It's got, you mix the kale with balsamic, a little maple syrup, and olive oil. The thing about kale is that it can be very fibrous and rough on your system. Mm-hmm. And so when you add acid and salt and oil, it's called massaging it. You rub it through. It softens and it becomes much more digestible. And there you have it with thin slices of apple, salty feta cheese, dates, and toasted walnuts and thin slices of celery. So it's this great balance of textures.
Oh, my gosh. I love Waldorf salads, which is just the walnuts, apples, and, you know.
Well, usually yucky mayonnaise.
Yeah. But this with the date.
Isn't that nice?
That was spectacular.
I really like that.
We should say the kale. I don't know. I think I can tell the difference between kale and regular lettuce. It's kind of crispier. It has an edge. But you said when you eat it minimally. We'll link people to an article that's on our home station's website. It has been one of the most popular for about a year now. It's called The Dark Side of Kale. It's about eating too much kale. We'll link you to that so you can know what she's talking about.
Okay, so all those hipsters in Brooklyn better watch their guts, huh?
That's Kathy Gunst. We're talking fall greens. It's here and now. So, Kathy, where do we go now?
Let's talk about some of the less known and less loved mustard greens. Wonderful fall green. They have a spicy bite, wonderful range of colors, dark maroons and these ruffled leaves. You can stir fry them. You can throw them into soups. They're terrific in salad to give you kind of a punch and a bite. One of my favorites is Swiss chard. Mm-hmm. Very delicate. It can be used interchangeably like spinach. One of the best varieties is called Bright Lights because it's this spectacular pink color.
When you say like spinach, do you mean in every use of spinach?
I do.
You can eat it raw. Steam it. Okay.
Yeah, when it's tender and young, you want to look for it. This time of year, it tends to get huge because it's been growing since late summer and the leaves are gigantic. They're so beautiful. I've been to parties where it's the centerpiece. Hmm. I mean, this beautiful, vibrant pink and green streaked leaf. It's just fabulous. Other things to look for, pak choy or bok choy.
What's the difference?
Those are the same. They are in the cabbage family. It's a favorite Asian green. And you have a plate in front of you there as well. It's an extremely mild cabbage, and it has incredible juice and crunch. This pak choy was
picked.
Is this
it?
That's it, yeah.
Oh, I see. I thought these were some sort of onion.
No, this is from my friend Brad's farm, Oldfields Farm, and they are so fresh. Taste them. The juice bursts. I mean, we're talking juicy.
Juice burst.
It happened. Isn't that fabulous? Mm-hmm. And it's all I did was stir fry some thinly sliced fresh ginger, and I chopped up the pak choy, and I added a little bit of spicy sesame oil and a touch of soy. I could eat that for breakfast, lunch,
and
dinner.
That's amazing.
Because it's so fresh. Yeah. But you should look for it this time of year because that all these cabbages are coming out now, and the green pak choy or bok choy is just so mild that people that normally have trouble with members of the cabbage family can really eat that.
And again, we've been talking about leafy greens, but these are, they look like celery pieces.
Well, they're in the cabbage family, and you see them in Chinese restaurants, and they're really wonderful when they're small, and they are very fresh this time of year.
Wow.
Speaking of members of the cabbage family, Brussels sprouts. I have grown Brussels sprouts, and they will last through a blizzard. I mean, that is a
They will last through a nuclear attack.
I actually adore them. I love to roast them. But a new way that I just tried, I found a recipe in a brand new wonderful book called A Boat, A Whale, and a Walrus by Seattle chef Renee Erickson and Jess Thompson. And you just shave Brussels sprouts when they're raw on a mandolin, or you could do it on a cheese grater. And then you finely chop apples and you add walnut oil and black pepper and a little bit of wine vinegar. Insanely delicious.
Wait. Do you, it's just
no
tossed?
Cook.
You don't
Everything,
cook it?
Nope. And what happens is that the acid in the vinegar and the nutty walnut oil creates this fabulous salad. Wonderful for this time of year.
And of course, roasted Brussels sprouts have become very...
The rage.
Yeah.
One of the things, a lot of people take the outer leaves off of the Brussels sprouts, but don't do that because when you roast them, they become like chips. In fact, when I cook with kids, I love to roast them at a very high temperature and they crisp up and we sprinkle salt on them and I call them Brussels chips.
Okay.
Also, collard greens, a real favorite in the South, obviously. Southerners love to cook them with ham hocks and bacon. They add vinegar. Collards tolerate really, really high temperatures and cold. They're very cold hardy. They are also a member of the cabbage family. Now, the other thing, Robin, so that you keep eating and feel good about yourself, all of these greens are so nutritious. We're talking like a lot of calcium and potassium, vitamin A, C, and K. So you should eat a lot of these.
Okay.
Not you particularly, but everyone. I've just been enjoying them in all these different ways. I made ramen, the Japanese noodle dish, the other day. I made a very simple broth, and I added miso and ginger, boiled up some noodles, and then I stir-fried all these mustard greens and topped the ramen. Heaven.
Ramen, the sixth food group of college kids.
That's right. But the real deal, yeah. Not the stuff right. out of the package.
Yeah. By the way, the bok choy, I just got a kick from that.
That's the spicy sesame oil. You could add a tiny bit of chili paste. It's nice because it's so mild and sweet and juicy to have just that little hint of spice there.
Fantastic. As usual, we will have all the recipes at hereandnow.org. These are fantastic. Kathy Gunst, thanks so much.
Enjoy. Thanks, Robin.
And I'm told we have a caller who called to say, don't forget, in order for these nutrients to be absorbed, you have to have some fat in there as well. No problem on my part. Well, while we're celebrating the bounty of fall, we have a reminder. There is a lack of abundance elsewhere. It is World Food Day, started in 1979 and now observed by millions of people in more than 150 countries, to think about people who don't get enough to eat. According to the UN, that's over 800 million people worldwide, a hard number to grasp. But the UN also says the number of people who go hungry is actually down by 100 million over the last decade. So there is hope. There's also legislation pending in Congress to strengthen Feed the Future, the U.S. drive to end global hunger. And Jeremy, there are all sorts of Food Day events in the U.S. 300. They include hunger walks. There's one in Pueblo, Colorado, one in Barrington, Illinois. There's a gleaning event in College Park, Maryland. I think of that great painting by Millet. There's a 36-hour fast and rave at Wichita State University in Kansas. And it's Hug a Farmer Day at the Connor Farm in Hilliard, Florida. How quickly can we get there? We'll have the full list at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.